We're going to make a start. It's really good to see you again. My name's Angus. It's great to see you for our second Forums of the Year. This term, today we are focusing on Box 1 of Two Ways to Live. I'm sure lots of you are familiar with it. Can anyone remember the new words that go with Box 1 of Two Ways to Live? God is the ruler of the world. He made the world and he made us to rule his good world. His good world, giving thanks and honour to him. This Box of Two Ways to Live is capturing our night tonight. Tonight we're thinking about creation, especially Genesis chapter 1. Before we dig into there, Philip's going to help us start by praying.
Last week we did really well on the praying, in learning the first and fundamental about praying together. Corporate prayer, individual prayer, slightly different things. There's something called good manners in corporate prayer, and that comes out by being audible, brief and concrete. Now the next step is to learn that when we pray, we should give thanks to God. In the New Testament, it keeps on saying, pray with thanksgiving, pray with thanksgiving. That's because thanksgiving is not prayer. Talking to God is not prayer. Prayer means asking for things. So when we pray, when we ask for things, we should say thank you for the things that we've been given as well. Because none of us are without something to thank God for. So tonight, I want you to be thanking God. Think quickly for yourself about something that you should be thanking God about. And saying thanksgiving is actually slightly trickier than praying. Just a harder thing to do. So I want you to limit it to one sentence. Now, some very clever people here will think of a sentence with many subordinate clauses that will go as long as the Apostle Paul in one of his 7 or 8 verses. But just keep it to the one sentence. And then ask for one thing. So as we go around the group, leading you to do what it is you're going to be asking God for and thanking God, thank God for something and pray for something in 1.5 sentences. You ready? Give thanks to God.
Audible, brief, concrete.
Thank you. It doesn't take long for God to hear our prayers. And remember, as a rule of life, start your prayers with God always with thank you. Because you're supposed to pray with thanksgiving. Count your blessings. Thanksgiving is really important. Christians have got someone to thank. Non-Christians, I thank my lucky stars, as if stars and luck have got anything to do with life. But we have somebody to thank for every good thing that we've got. We're looking at Genesis 1. And in looking at Genesis 1, 1 through to 2, 4, and we're going to read this in a moment or two, but when we're looking at it, I want you to ask a question of you to mention with the people around about you. What are the questions that you have when you study Genesis 1? This is a very quick discussion one, just quickly within groups and I'll collect up the answers as to what it is that you, what are the questions you're asking when you come to Genesis 1? Yes, you've got all these questions before you start. Hands up those who have ever seen the little YouTube clip of the experiment about monkey business, the illusion about monkey business. About the people passing a basketball between each other. Oh, that one. Yeah, that monkey business one. Hands up now. You've seen that one. Okay, good. A spoiler alert is you're told to count the number of times the people in the white shirt pass the basketball and... because you're counting it seriously, you don't notice that a gorilla walks straight across the stage and pops it. It's all right, because they've made a second volume. They've made a second one, which is actually different, so I don't mind spoiling that one for you. Because now you know, most people, about half the people, do not see the gorilla walk across the stage because they're counting the number of times the white shirts are passing the ball. And they're concentrating so hard on that, they missed the blindly obvious, weird thing of a gorilla walking straight across the stage. Look up the second volume later and you'll see they've extended it and made it even more interesting. But this is what Genesis 1 is like. If you concentrate on the questions that you've been asking, you won't understand Genesis 1 because you're not looking for the gorilla. You're looking for all these other things which Genesis 1's not answering. It's like Agatha Christie. Agatha Christie, I remember reading years ago, she said it's always easy to use a maid because the maid and the butler are not people. They're just functionaries. And so no one notices them. And so they hear, they live, they act, but they are not noticed because they're just functionaries. And if you're a functionary, a gatekeeper or something like that, people treat you like that. It's as if you don't exist as a human. They don't say hello to you. They don't greet you. They don't find anything about you. People treat people like that in shops today. And it's really quite nasty. Don't be like that. Always say hello to the person and ask them how their day is and the rest of it, right? I won't go on. That's a moral lesson for another day. But Genesis 1 to 11 is like that, and Genesis 1 in particular. You have your questions. Well, bully for you. How about we read Genesis and find out what Genesis' questions are of you rather than your questions of Genesis? You see, this is the real one. What are the five most prominent themes in Genesis 1? That's a good question to ask because it actually is saying I'm trying to understand the literature rather than try to understand the answers to my question. Can anyone tell me the colour of the equator? No, the equator doesn't have a colour. But as long as you ask the question, what is the colour of the equator, you'll never find the answer because you're asking the wrong question, aren't you? The art of research is not finding the answers. The art of research is asking the right questions and getting rid of all the wrong ones that are in your head. All your questions, very interesting, lovely and fascinating, but really, this is the question. What are the five most prominent things? That is, throughout it, you'll hear the word, I'm going to give you a sixth one, good. 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 Very good. There's a theme. The author is trying to tell you something about good in creation. And the word good, I take it, means fulfills God's purposes. He does something and he says, nah, that's good. That's fulfilled what his aim and intention was. That's good. Now, what are the other five? It's going to be read for you. We're going to have Olivia and Edmund reading for us, aren't we? You better do it out the front here in Genesis 1. And then straight afterwards, we'll discuss with ourselves what are those five things quickly. Come up with your five.
Genesis 1 from the ESV. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said,
let there be light.
And there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said,
let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters.
And God made the expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse. And it was so. And God called the expanse heaven. And there was evening and there was morning, the second day. And God said,
let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear.
And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said,
let the earth sprout vegetables, vegetation, plant yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth.
And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the third day. And God said,
let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons, and for days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth.
And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said,
Let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens.
So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm, according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying,
Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters in the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth.
And there was evening, and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said,
Let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things and beasts of the earth according to their kinds.
And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and the livestock according to their kinds, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said,
Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth.
So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them,
Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth.
And God said,
Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food.
And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done. And he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation.
Okay, what are the five main themes that you've come up with? Just talk them with each other and I'll get one least from each group. Now, I've picked on five that I want to be spoken about, and we're going to have 2-minute talks from different people now on these five. The first is going to be from Emma, because one of the great themes, do you want me to tell them the theme as you come up? Yeah, is God. You might miss that because it's so expected, you see, but the word God is the most common word in the whole passage. It's about God. The passage is about God. Well, Emma, tell us about it.
It was a bright, cold day in April, and the clocks were striking 13. It almost blew my socks off when I first read this. Does anyone know what book it's from?
1984.
There we go, 1984. What a grand opening line. And as I've read Genesis 1, I've come to see that we have an even grander opening line. In the beginning, God. The curtains open and God is the front of stage. The spotlights are on him. God exists and Genesis 1 is all about him. I think I counted the word God 32 times. Cameron can probably top that, some careful counting, in the chapter. And so often he's the subject of all the verses. Before anything else, here is God with no rival. Nothing and no one else existed. Yet God chose to create, and he created something incredible. Genesis 1, verse 1, says, In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The one God chose to create our whole universe. This is all his work, and he intended to make it, and he did. Everything and everyone throughout history all belongs to him, the king and the ruler. And he's not some distant impersonal force, but he is our personal creator who enjoys his creation. He saw that it was good. And what an incredible privilege that he's revealed himself as our powerful and personal creator.
Good Edmund's going to come to us and talk to us about creation itself, as to what we mean by creation. Thank you, Emma.
God was the subject. The object, what has God been doing, is creation. He created things. Well, he created creation. This might be a simple diagram that you're seeing, but don't underestimate it. It will help debunk 90% of the misunderstandings of creation. It's quite simple. We have creator, who's God, and then there's that line, and then underneath it is creation. The creator is not creation, and the creation is not creator. The creator is eternal. Our creation is not. Creation has a beginning. In the beginning, God created. The creator does not have a beginning. Creation does. There was a time when the creation was not. There is no time when the creator was not. So you need to respect the red line. Creation depends on creator. Creator does not depend on creation. And what is it that we can learn from creation itself? I've wrote there the specs. What's the specs of creation? It's an acronym. S is for source. Creation comes from the creator. P, well, it's position. P for position. Creation is under God. It's under the creator. E for extent. What does creation encompass or extend to? Well, everything that's not God. God created everything. C, the character of creation. Well, it's ordered, it's purpose. And lastly, S, the standard or the quality. How good is the quality of creation? Well, it is good. That is, and if you can't remember, ask your neighbour what spec stands for.
Good. Ashley's going to bring us now to talk about the word.
I'm going to speak about a theme which is word. And I hope you noticed a lot of that come up throughout the whole of Genesis 1, that God created by his word. Genesis 1 gives us a picture of a God who speaks and creation comes into being. He created by his word. We see this multiple times. It says, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. God said, let there be something, and there was something. He just speaks, and it happens. So everything we see in our world and our universe, God spoke, and it was so. And you can notice here as well, the author doesn't try to kind of explain all these technical details about how exactly these things came to be. He's not setting out to write some technical scientific report of creation. But the author does highlight two things. God creating by his word shows the power of God, and God creating by his word shows the meaningfulness of creation. Firstly, the power of God. His power is well and truly on display. Again, all he had to do was speak, and it happened. And I don't think there's a creature, any creature that we just talked about, anything in creation, us, anything that has the power to do that. Maybe the closest we see it is when we look at the most powerful people in our world, like the commander of an army or the leader of a country. They don't do the actions themselves, but they speak and others act for them. But God is on another level in Genesis 1. We see his power and might. He speaks and it happens. It's not like he has to then get minions to do his work for him, but he speaks and creates from nothing. He creates by his word and shows his great power. The second thing we see is also the meaningfulness of creation. Our world and our universe wasn't just an accident. It wasn't the result of a random happening, random particles pushing together. It wasn't a mistake either. It wasn't an afterthought. And creation wasn't just an extension of God, like some other part of him. But God is a personal God. He spoke. Creation came into existence. But God actually intentionally communicated his plan, and it came to be. So God knew what he was doing when he made the world and the universe. Everything that was formed in creation has meaning. The sun, the moon, the birds, the plants, and particularly for us, humanity. We are part of a meaningful and purposeful creation. And I think it's really comforting to know that we have a meaning and a purpose. We have a personal God who chose to create. He spoke his words intentionally. So we see that God speaking by his word shows both his power and shows the meaningfulness of creation.
Well, we go to humanity with Angus.
Well, we're up to you and me. Humanity, right? We are in a sense the climax of creation, climax of created things. Did you see it there in verse 26? Verse 26, let's look down and let's read it together. Verse 26, then God said, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them, and God blessed them. Let's keep going. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And so on. I mean, did you see the change in language? God's gone from "let there, let there, let there" to "let us make man in our image." I mean, we're not too sure what the "us" means. Don't get hung up there. It could just be a royal plural. But I mean, it's a fairly unique position for humans, right? Humanity is created in the image of God. Humans are not like the rest of creation. Humans hold a really special, privileged role in creation. But I mean, at the same time, we're not that different, right? We're still created. We are creation. We're not God. We're part of this material, physical, created world. We're still the same. But we bear the image of God. We bear the image of God. We are unique. And God instructs his image bearers, we read it just then, his image bearers to rule creation, have dominion over all things, to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. But you see, all of it's under God, right? All of it's under God. Humanity reigns over all under God. Let's put that away. Overall, under God. I mean, huge topic. It touches on, these verses touches on so many things. Euthanasia, I mean, ecology, abortion, capital punishment. I mean, there's the list goes on that these verses are so foundational to touch upon. We don't have time to look at that today, but ask Philip later in question time if you want to. Come and find somebody. We can point you in the right direction for good books to think about those kind of things. But one of the important things that happens next is rest. So
we go to Olivia with rest.
So in this creation account, we've seen that God is the subject, creation the object, the word as the means of creating, humanity as the climax, and the resolution of creation is rest. So we have this climactic creation of humanity. God sees that everything he has made is very good, not just good, very good. And then he completes his work of creating all the heavens and the earth, and then he rests on the seventh day. So we see all of God's work of creating leading to this resolution of God at rest when he purposely stops his work of creating new things, so it's not continuous, and he blesses the seventh day and declares it to be holy, or set apart. This day of rest is special because it never ends. There's no evening and morning like the other days. So Genesis 1 and 2 points us forward to the reality of an eternal rest, of God's purpose of creating the world to rest in him, and of his presence beyond the time of this created world where there's eternal rest with God. So being with God in his holy day of rest is the ultimate conclusion of creation.
Okay. In understanding this, you need to understand the alternatives. Sometimes you don't see what the truth is till you realize what the lies are that the truth is excluding. Let me give you some of the alternatives that are around. You see, there is dualism, which believes that there is the eternal existence of two opposing forces. And from these two opposing forces, the world has been caught up between them. Or there's polytheism, the existence of many, many gods. And different gods have fought battles with each other, and parts of the world are one thing, and some gods look after one bit and other gods look after another bit. This passage is saying God. God made everything. No other. There's just one God, you see. Or there's astrology. I mean, I just cannot believe in astrology. I just find it hard to believe that intelligent people still believe in astrology, but they do. It's in the newspapers every day, newspapers that try and tell us that we're supposed to take them seriously. Astrology is the belief that the heavenly bodies are all over the affairs and affect the affairs of worlds and people. And so if you're born in this month, you're that kind of personality, whereas if you're born in that month, you'd be this kind of personality. And if you're born on this day, all the stars would affect you in this way and that way, and it's complete, absolute nonsense. However, this passage is anti-astrological. Do you notice that? Because it tells you the stars are not there to rule over you. The stars were there just as markers for us to see. Quite different completely. Now, astrology was well known in the ancient world. It can hardly be accidental that Genesis 1 gives a place to the stars that puts them under God and for the purposes of humans rather than over humans as alternative gods. Right? This is an anti-astrological tract, if you like. But if you're not thinking astrology, you're just trying to work out about Mr. Darwin, you miss out on what is being said because you didn't see the gorilla walk across the stage because you were counting the number of white shirts. Or there's pantheism, the belief that everything is God. Our very deep green people come to this, that the world itself, God, Gaia, the world is God. It is the divine of which we participate as humans. And the creation, actually, if there is a God outside of creation, well, there's not. The creation is just an emanation of God. It's just the spreading out of God, the extension of God, but the creation itself. There's no big line between the creator and the creation. The creation is the creator. You see? Or there's henotheism, the belief that each nation has its own God. There's the God of the Assyrians, there's the God of the Babylonians, there's the God of Israel, there's the God of... And each of these gods just are there to look after their own people, their own nation. This is ultimate multiculturalism, isn't it? That the gods who look after these nations are just as valid as the gods who look after those nations. Or there's deism, which is the idea that God made the world like a clock, but it is a self-sustaining clock. Doesn't even need continued winding up, but just is going to roll on until entropy. And God has actually no ongoing interest in it or supervision over it. It just is here, and of which you and I are part of the mechanisms. That's you are just part of the machinery that God has made. That is, Genesis 1 is going off in a direction completely different to all the other ancient world religions and philosophies that were operating, and saying something quite unique and extraordinary and significant, which we, because many of us have grown up in a Christianized Western world, take for granted. See, some of these, pantheism would never lead you ultimately to do science. Henotheism would only lead you to patriotism. It won't lead you to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It can't be a Universal Declaration of Human Rights because every nation has their own gods. So you don't come to that. But see, you and I, we just take for granted the heritage that has come out of Genesis 1 about the idea of one God creating everything in an orderly fashion. Science comes out of Genesis 1. Because it's the idea that creation actually exists independently of God, that we humans placed in dominion can actually look at it and understand it. And the creation that God has made is an orderly creation. It's not random. So if you don't really follow the creation, you'll never come to scientific understanding. The whole exercise, the whole process of thinking scientifically, of thinking that there's an orderliness, there's a pattern that can be studied and understood, comes out of Genesis 1. It's just the basic assumption of the scientific inquiry. You can trace this out in History and Philosophy of Science books. You'll see it in Christy Burkett's book on Darwinism. the essence of Darwinism, or you'll see it in that lovely Oxford mathematician. What's his name? The Irishman? John Lennox and his books about the history of science. You'll see it there. It's a well-known aspect of the nature of scientific inquiry. There was a historian in the middle of the 20th century called Herbert Butterfield, who was the professor of history at Cambridge University, and he writes on, you know, it's been around for, you know, 70-odd years, the understanding that actually Genesis 1 is the philosophical foundation of scientific inquiry. You've got to understand Genesis 1 in terms of its alternatives. There are two main alternatives to draw your attention to, of which I did last week, although I used a different word. I used spiritual last week, but now I remembered alliteration. All preachers like alliteration, so I've come up with mysticism. It means I can hold the thing together in my head a little easier. There's materialism and mysticism, with material being the eternal existence of matter and the non-existence of all else. And so it really is basically atheism. The world has always been. Well, it does have a little problem with the Big Bang theory, doesn't it? But then what happened before the Big Bang is a problem in itself, isn't it? However, the philosophy of the steady state of the universe was built on materialism. Professor Fred Hoyle of, again, Cambridge University in the middle, late 20th century, argued for the steady state theory of the creation, that is, it's always been. But his whole theories of steady state have been rejected because of the discovery of the Big Bang theory, of the expansion and expansory nation, that actually the creation has not always been in one steady state. It continuing. So, but there's materialism, the theory that physical matter is the only reality and that your psychological states, such as emotions, reasons, thought, desire, actually can all be displayed in physical terms. You have grey matter and it twitches. And its twitching gives you meaning, gives you purpose, gives you feelings, gives you whatever you think of yourself as a person, it's just the twitching of your grey matter. Now, there's a lot in psychological studies today which shows that how people's grey matter operates does affect deeply how they feel and think about things. On the other hand, we've also discovered recently that our brains, our grey matter, is plastic, that actually it can be taught new ways of thinking and feeling, that it's not fixed. It's not like you've got the hardware and the software, because the software can change the hardware in the brain. That actually, if you do certain things often enough, the hardware of your brain will be changed by doing those things, which is great news for stroke victims, isn't it? Because they can reinvent the pathways of thought which enable them to walk and talk again. So it's a little bit more complicated materialism. Mysticism goes to the other end of the spectrum. Right? That is, there's concern for the non-physical realities, the exclusion concern of the physical. The physical doctrine that all reality is spiritual, not material. Some even will say, there is no world here. The Hare Krishnas, if you ever meet up with them, think the world does not exist. It's all an illusion. Christian Science believe the world does not exist. It is just an illusion. That really the only existence is how you feel about things, how you think about things. And one of the things that you shouldn't think is the world exists. So there we go. There's two main alternatives, which I'm going to mention, because you'll come across them soon enough. Mysticism is down the Buddhism, Hindu line. Materialism is down the atheistic, agnostic line. They're the more... You don't meet many henotheists these days. You don't meet many dualists these days. They're around. I could introduce you to them, but these are the two that you'll most commonly meet as alternatives to Genesis 1. But Angus is going to bring us now our word from the... isn't Angus going to bring us a word of advertisements? And from I thought you were. Now, this next exercise for you is going to take longer. We'll be here for some time on this next one. You see, the the five themes that we picked on, and there are others, as we can see, like the very theme good, so you can add to six if you want to, are not just in Genesis 1 to 11. They're not just in Genesis 1, they're throughout the Bible. So what I want now is for you to show where else in the Bible God made all from nothing, that creation is brought into existence, is dependent upon God, that the Word of God was the way which the world was created, that humanity was made in God's image, and that there is rest from creation. So where else in the Bible are those taught? And this is Bible flipping time, friends, and you've got to be helpful to each other, because some of you have never found anything in the Bible before tonight, and others know it from Genesis to Revelation. So be kind to each other and help each other find where these things are.
Let's pool our knowledge together now. We're hearing from different places about these points. Tell us here about God creating, well, about God, isn't it? God making everything from nothing. Where do you find that in the Bible? How about Isaiah 45? Why don't you turn up Isaiah 45?
Nobody's mentioned that one, have they? Isaiah 45. Pick it up from, say, verse 5. I am the Lord, that's Yahweh. I am Yahweh, there's no other. Beside me there is no God. I equip you, though you do not know me, that people may know from the rising of the sun and from the west that there is none beside me. I am Yahweh, there is no other. I form light, create darkness. I make well-being and create calamity. I am the Lord who does all these things. Shower, O heavens, from above. Let the clouds rain down righteousness. Let the earth open that salvation and righteousness may bear fruit. Let the earth cause them both to sprout. I, Yahweh, have created it. Woe to him who strives with him who formed him, a pot among earthen vessels. Does the clay say to him who forms it, what are you making, or your work has no handles? So it goes on throughout this chapter, speaking of God's sovereignty in creating all things, including humans. That God is created by his word. Okay, where else do you find that humanity is in the image of God? Chapter 3, verse 9. Can you read it out loud for us, please? Yes. So the image and likeness of God is something for humanity. And what about rest from creation? Where do we see the Bible teach about rest?
Hebrews 4, the whole of chapter Hebrews 3 and 4 is about the rest of God and our participation in it, yes?
The promised land is the land of rest. And the people troubled there were to get rest. And so they were to rest because Exodus 20, God created the world in 6 days and rested. And they were to rest in Deuteronomy 5, in the Ten Commandments there, because they were slaves and were now being taken to the land of rest. But Psalm 95 tells us that the people didn't enter into the rest because they sinned in the wilderness. So that whole generation died without ever reaching the rest of God. But Hebrews chapter 4 tells us about how Jesus brings us rest, and so we can now enter into the rest. And very importantly, there's no eighth day of creation. Within 7 days, God did it all in the 6 days and rested the seventh. Now, my friends, here are themes. Genesis 1 is the prelude to the whole Bible. Themes that run all the way through the Bible are actually given to us in Genesis 1. Now, we don't understand them yet. You know, there's a lot to be unpacked in the rest of the Bible about the image of God, or about the doctrine of rest, or about the nature of God and his sovereignty. All these things have yet to be unpacked, but they're all there in just 30 verses. Again, stop asking Genesis 1 to answer questions it's not answering, and listen to the questions that it's asking you and the answers that it is giving you, because it's laying out the foundations for a house that you will see come in the near future. So I want to show you the implications of Genesis 1 compared to materialism, and we won't have time, I think, to do the mysticism. But it's the same thing. In materialism, the world is meaningless. It's an accident. Bang, here it is. Accidents don't have meaning. There's no purpose, there's no rhyme, there's no meaning. They just happen. They're just happenings. And so You may think, well, I like to be an atheist so I don't actually have to obey God. But in fact, what you mean is you want to live in a world that is completely meaningless. If it is meaningless, then it is amoral. There's no right and wrong. There's no true and false. There just is. That's all there is. We're here because 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 we're here. That's what life is about. Nothingness. Absolute meaningless nothingness. That's the character of it. And if that's the case, your life will become profoundly self-centered because the only thing that you have is yourself and your own experiences, your own feelings. And so the heart of atheism is meaningless, amoral self-centeredness, which would be immoral, except they don't have any morals. And this whole philosophy is, I want to suggest to you, unlivable and untrue. Unlivable and untrue. Now, the same problem happens with mysticism. It also has a view of life which turns to be meaningless. It's a different kind of meaninglessness. The world's going around and round and round in cycles nowhere. Every 5,000 years, the Stoics thought the world came into existence again, went through the same cycle. And so you go through reincarnation. You live out your life now, then you come back as something else and live that life out and come back and live. Ultimately, if you've got one of the ones that's a spiral, you'll go up to nirvana, and nirvana is where nothing happens. That's absolute nothingness. It's all meaningless in that world, and therefore amoral. Some of them have morality, like karma, but karma just means next time you'll come back as a cockroach because you didn't listen to Philip Jensen and were kind and laughed at his jokes or whatever it might be that is your particular karma. And so, again, it winds up as self-centered. It's all about me and my... It's not social. It's not social justice. And again, it is unlivable and untrue. Indian government at the moment is imposing upon other states than the really hardline Hindu states the idea that you mustn't kill cows. There are certain states in India where it's illegal to kill cows. There are other states like Kerala where it is legal at the moment. But because the cow is just as human as the human is, then it is wrong to be killing cows. And so the cows are destroying the food quantities of India. People are starving, but the cows are living on. Indeed, you can't actually kill rats. And so you get plagues, but you can't remove them because they're all just part of the same spirit world that we are in. You don't get science out of Hinduism. So you think, Philip, this is extreme rant of a white, old, fat, middle-aged, fat, old, male Christian Australian. A woman came to me once at a meeting and she said, the trouble with you, Philip, is you're a fat, white male. And I said to her, well, I'll go on a diet and I'll get out in the sun and tan up a lot. That's it. I'm not dealing with a third one. I'm staying away. Anyway, it's not just a rant of what I'm saying. I'm telling you what the people who believe these things say. So here is a book by a great professor of philosophy, Thomas Nagel, at New York University. He wrote a book about what does it all mean? And in it he writes, but what's the point of being alive at all? And his answer is, there's no point. Wouldn't matter if I didn't exist or all, if I didn't care about anything. But I do, that's the trouble. See, here's the unlivability of it. It is totally meaningless, and I am totally meaningless, but I think I've got a meaning somehow. And so his book on what's it all about, what's it all mean, winds up with a line, life may not only be meaningless but absurd. That's true atheism. Professor Joel Marx, a professor of philosophy, said I was a moral fool because he argued for morality for 30 years. But in the end, he came to the conclusion he was wrong. He was a complete fool. There is no morality. He said, my shocking epiphany is that the religious fundamentalists are correct. Without God, there's no morality. Now, there's a solution for him there, isn't there? Except God. No. He said, there's no morality. So he locked himself up in his house for a year, trying to work out what he should do now without any morality, because he'd lived his life arguing for morality, and he now knew there was no morality. No reason to tell anybody the truth. Truth doesn't matter. Very hard if you're a philosopher teaching about truth and you now find there is no truth. you're a moralist teaching ethics and you discover that there is no basis for ethics. But that was the situation he was in. And I guess it leads to self-centeredness. I mean, I keep on telling you the old song about Frank Sinatra, I did it my way. But I'm sick of telling you about that one. So I thought I'd tell you about Sammy Davis Jr., who wrote the song about, he didn't write it, but he made it popular, I've Got to Be Me, whether I'm right, whether I'm wrong, whether I find a place in this world or never belong. I've got to be me. I've got to be me. What else can I be but what I am? When you analyse and you look at that, that is profound self-centeredness. You can't help but wind up as a selfish person if that's your philosophy of life. But that's atheism. It's classic atheism, although Sammy himself became Jewish. But that's another story. However, his song lives on. Because today, we are now selling cars by his song. You know that, don't you? It comes up fairly frequently on television. Now, what do I do now? Press that? There
we go. I want to live. Not this world survive. Give up this dream of life that keeps me alive. I gotta be free. I've gotta be free. Daring to try to do it or die. I've gotta be me. I'll go it alone. That's how it must be. I can't be right for somebody else if I'm not right for me. I gotta be free. I just gotta be free. I gotta be me.
I've gotta be free. I've gotta be me. Doesn't matter whether it's right or wrong or anything, it's all about me. Now, dear friends, for those of you who know about Foucault and postmodernism of the 1990s, that was written in the 1960s. It predates, it goes a long way back. Atheism is totally, utterly self-centred. That is the very nature, that is the logical outworking of it, and you can sell cars by it. It really, I haven't bought a Toyota, Mitsubishi, that's what it is, I haven't done that. But you get it in all kinds of things. Disney. There we go. It's time to see what I can do to test the limits and to break through. No right, no wrong. No rules for me. No, I'm free. And you notice the nice little modest girl she is suddenly becomes, see the change in clothing that happens? We're feeding it to the children. We're feeding it through the cars. We're feeding it through society. But it's just materialism. Philosophical materialism creates economic materialism. And anybody with a moral conscience in the slightest says, I don't like it. Germaine Greer. Human beings have an inalienable right to invent themselves. There is a new right for life, isn't it? She will not let anybody else write her biography. She will not let anybody describe her. She alone is sovereign over her. When you read her life story, you'll see how miserable and unhappy she has been through most of it. And you see, the idea of materialism, that your brain, your grey matter, gives you all your emotions, all your sense. Well, here's a psychologist who believes it, Professor Jesse Prince. Again, at New York, I think he is now. No amount of reasoning can engender a moral value because all values are at bottom emotional attitudes. When I see pedophilia and I say that is disgusting and wrong, we've got to stop that. Well, it's just telling something about my psychological fear of pedophiles. I'm obviously a pedophobic. Right? I mean, that's the problem, isn't it? I need counselling to be freed from my phobia about pedophiles. Because there is nothing wrong with pedophilia. It's just a feeling that I have, and I hope you have as well. But that's atheism. The judgment that something is morally wrong is an emotional response. Now, I won't give you the mysticism ones.
They're more complicated and take a little longer. But see, when I went on my rant, you think, well, there's the old, white, fat Christian male. I'm saying the atheists are saying the same things themselves. You don't have to read what they're saying to see there is no meaning, there is no purpose, therefore there is no morality, therefore life is about self-centeredness, and the key of your self-centeredness lies in your emotions, which are all just part of your brain, and if we change your brain a little bit, you'll get different emotions. So, you know, have a lobotomy, feel better about yourself. Take some more medicines. Take this, that, see, here's, amuse yourself to death. Well, last time I told you about a spiritualist, about Ramani Maharaj, I mentioned that his father was beyond the use of mantras. We all considered him to be in direct communication with a Brahmin. So here's the mystic. So completely had he turned within to realise the true self that he never acknowledged any human presence, although admirers came from miles around to worship him. No one ever aroused a response from him. He seemed to be in another world. Like the gods in the prayer room, he did nothing physically for himself. He was a god to be taken care of, washed, fed and changed. For 8 years, my father had followed Lord Krishna's instructions about giving up all attachments to position, desires, physical realm. No wonder people marvelled and came far near to worship him. Here is the ultimate pinnacle of the mystic human. He sat for 8 years and had other people feed him, wash him, dress him, sleep him. He spoke to no one, he loved no one, he cared for no one, and then he died. There is the end point of mysticism. Here's the life story of another man, Philip Adams. He's on radio. He's been an atheist arguing against Christians for a long time now. I think he's older than me. I think that's possible. To me, he says, the universe is meaningless. There's no destiny, no author to creation. To me, life is just a little brief flash in the infinite darkness. But he goes on, it's important to love. Why is it important to love if it's just a flash of nothingness? It's important to love. We should be generous, charitable and so on. I think that's just common sense. In other words, it's unlivable, his view. The longer I live, the more I realise that if you can't love or accept love, and both things are pretty tricky, then you are in deep trouble. The only satisfactions that I would really regard as being meaningful are those. See the self-centeredness? I love Emily because it makes me feel good. It's all about my satisfactions. Blow Emily, she's an irrelevance. She's just there to make me feel good. You see, it's all about my satisfactions. It's appalling, unlivable philosophy of atheism. And so he goes on, recognises it's unlivable. Sorry, this one gets very small, but because of my enormous sense of life's brevity, I tried to crowd life with incidents and I lived a dozen lives at once, so I became hyperactive in all sorts of ways, thinking that this would in some way work for me, and I found more and more it didn't, that it became more and more hollow. I now look back with some grief at the price I paid and the price I made others pay for that journey of mine. I realise now I was remarkably selfish in many ways. I never gave friendship everything like the importance I should have given it. I realised that I hadn't invested much time in personal relationships. I'd been too busy doing a dozen things and juggling five careers at once, and I now regret, for instance, not having been a wonderful father to my three daughters. It doesn't work because it's not true. Because there is God. And we are in his image. See, there's a very big gulf between the two. And the atheist and the materialist, with its scientific successfulness, has been glamorized right down to little children and all the way through selling cars by all the songs that we're hearing and by the books that we're reading, without mentioning the horrors that are involved in such atheism. Well, let me go to the questions that you've asked. Is Genesis literal or figurative? Why do you ask that question? I'm not asking the person who asked it. I'll look the other way. Why are you asking that question? It's because you want to create a genre of literature. Because once you create the genre of literature, you then have rules that you can apply to the literature. So you're trying to create some law over the law of God by which you can judge the law of God. Right? It's a false way of reading. You've just got to read Genesis for Genesis. You said literary, figurative or literal. What if it's a parable? You know? Parables of Jesus. Are the parables of Jesus fiction or history? You don't know. There could have been a man who fell amongst thieves on the way down to Jericho. And there could have been priests and Levites who walked past. And there could have been a good Samaritan who picked him up and took him down and put him in the hotel. It could be just recounting something that happened yesterday, couldn't it? Or it could be just an imaginary story that Jesus is telling in order to make a point. Because you don't have to know whether it's history or fiction in order to see the point of the Good Samaritan, do you? You've asked the wrong question of the Good Samaritan when you ask the question, is it history or not? Well, likewise, you're doing exactly the same with Genesis. And the reason you wanted to ask the question is so as to condemn the passage as not fitting in with your preconceived, predetermined, prejudicial view of literature. Number two. I'm in a friendly mood tonight. The intellectual questions of Genesis. What are the smokescreens that lie behind the real question? Yes, it's humans unwilling to take responsibility to God. Once you accept Genesis, you have God and you are made in his image and are answerable to him. Get rid of God. I'm not answerable to God. I can do anything I want to do. Now what do I want to do? Please myself. Because there is no God, there is no right, there is no wrong, there is no purpose, there is no meaning. There's just my grey matter twitching inappropriately.